Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. A documentary film called The House I Live In takes a critical and comprehensive look at the 40-year war on drugs in the United States. The House I Live In, directed by Eugene Jarecki, was named the best documentary at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The judges called it the definitive film on the failure of America's drug war. Joining us in the Global Journalist studio the day after the film was screened here in Missouri is the producer of The House I Live In, Melinda Shopson. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is one of several films that Melinda has worked with Eugene Jarecki. One of them was Why We Fight, a documentary about the military-industrial complex and the negative aspects of military expansion. That documentary also won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival in 2005. The House I Live In is about the growth of the prison industrial complex, but that's just one aspect of this multidimensional film. Before Melinda gives us an inside look at this documentary, let's start from the beginning, a clip from the movie's trailer in which President Nixon first declares the drug war in 1971, followed by comments from Nancy Reagan, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and a former crime reporter who created the HBO police series The Wire, David Simon.
America's public enemy number one is drug abuse.
What will you do when someone offers you drugs?
We intend to end the drug menace and to eliminate this dark, evil enemy within.
Put him away. Put him away where they
belong. Three strikes and you are out.
Somebody down the road said drugs are bad. Okay, there's no argument there. But think about where we are 30 years later.
So, Melinda, where are we today, and why are we calling the drug war a failure?
So David Simon says 30 years, but it's actually 40 years. $1 trillion spent, 45 million arrests. Drugs are cheaper. They're more available. They're more potent. We have 2.3 million people incarcerated in this country. That is, you know, we have 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of those incarcerated. Of those 2.3 million people, 500,000 are for nonviolent drug arrests violations. Right. So it's not looking too good. I spent 4 years making this film and visited, you know, 20, 25 states, going into prisons, federal courtrooms, communities. And the most surprising thing to me was not that this is a failure, but that everybody involved kind of knows it. The police officers, the wardens, the prison guards, the judges, prosecutors, everyone you talk to agrees that our strategy to decrease drug use in our society is not working, that we are locking people up for extremely long sentences and they are coming out and they are not reforming, that they're going right back in. It's really amazing to think that 40 years of policy have led to such a monumental failure that everybody agrees is a failure, and we keep perpetuating those problems.
And 4 years spent making this film, it must have been a great deal of research, reporting, interviews, film editing. I think you said last night that there was 800 hours of footage.
Yeah, we have an incredible amount of footage. We were really lucky in that we had a lot of rope to go out with, that we could go and get on the ground and film everywhere we went, but sort of also be learning all the time on the ground, besides, you know, all the research we did, talking to experts behind the scenes, reading books and studies and statistics. The best way to really find out about things is to talk to people who are intimately involved with this issue. And that's what we tried to do in the film, is to bring human stories in and to really showcase what people inside of this issue think about it. And so for us, we feel like that's one of the best ways to understand an issue.
Right. Even though there's a lot of impressive statistics about this problem, America being the world's largest jailer, the destruction that it's caused in the black community, but this movie is very character driven. So I want to talk about a few of the characters that you selected to help tell this story. One of them is the prison guard in Oklahoma, Mike Carpenter. And I'd like to play a clip from his interview in the film, which also includes a voiceover with director Jarecki and comments from Joe Biden and Bill Clinton.
I am very much a law and order kind of guy. I would rather have 10 police cars than one soup kitchen, if you give me the choice. But sometimes I think that we need to be smarter about what those police officers are actually out there doing.
Maybe because he seemed the epitome of a hardened prison official, Mike Carpenter's perspective on the severity of drug laws caught me off guard.
I think a long time ago, we made drugs into this huge thing, and we've made it so illegal, and we've made it such a national issue with that tough-on-crime stance. I mean, you can't get elected if you don't profess to be tough on crime.
First, we have to join together to ensure that drug dealers are punished swiftly, surely, and severely.
You can't stay elected if you don't do things to be tough on crime.
It's to toughen sentences, beef up law enforcement, and build new prison space for 24,000 inmates.
You know, nobody can afford to be the first guy to say, wait a minute, we can't afford what we're doing, let's do something different. Because if you even made a noise like you were going to be soft on crime in any way, you would be out of a job.
You will be put away and put away for good. Three strikes and you are out.
How did Mike Carpenter come to play such a large role in the movie?
You know, very randomly. We were filming in Oklahoma at this Lexington facility where he was at the time. He was chief of security there. He's since actually been promoted to another job. Mm-hmm. And I saw him, and it's like one of those guys where you go, oh, that guy's maybe my villain. Like, maybe that guy's going to tell me I'm completely wrong and give me the other side of the coin, which I'm always looking for.
And he's a big guy.
He's a big guy. Yeah, he's imposing, and he's got keys and handcuffs, and you think like, wow, okay.
And he talks about how secure his prison
is. Yeah, it's secure. And so I started talking to him, and pretty instantaneously I realized, wow, this guy is an incredible intellect. He is completely thoughtful about what he's saying. And after talking to him for a little, I was completely blown away that we shared a lot of the same ideas. And where I had got to them from research, he had got to them from being inside a prison for, 10 years and watching mm-hmm. what these incredibly long sentences for nonviolent offenses had done. And he's not a Democrat. He is not soft. He is very conservative. But we are able to see from his experiences on the job that he, too, believes these policies aren't working and that we need to start to think about a different way of approaching our problems.
Right. And you also have great access to that prison. That was pretty surprising. And one of the other key characters that came out of this was the inmate sentenced to life for possession of
Kevin Ott.
3 ounces of methamphetamine.
Yeah, he was on a 3 strikes law. He got put away, so he had an offense for marijuana. He had an offense for hitting his wife, which whatever that is. He had a gun in his house because it was a shotgun and he lives in Oklahoma. And then on his third one, he had 3 ounces of methamphetamine that he was selling. And he got put away on a 3 strikes law that says if you have 3 laws, the last one's trafficking, you go away for life without parole. Not just life, so life without parole. So he's never actually hurt anyone. He's in a cell. He's been there for 13 years. The guy next to him is in jail for murder and will be out in 5 years. And he'll be in prison till he dies unless something changes, which actually in Oklahoma during this, we had a very exciting election cycle this year. And in Oklahoma, they passed a new amendment that you're to get a pardon, it doesn't have to be signed by the governor anymore. So he can go in front of the parole board again and try again, wherein he had already been denied and wasn't going to have another chance. So that's exciting for Kevin, that there is actually this new legislative opportunity.
Right. And why do you think that prison gave you such great access?
You know, I I think they are proud of their facilities, and I think they're happy to have us go in and show it. And also the head of corrections in Oklahoma, a man by the name of Justin Jones, who we interviewed that didn't end up in the film, is also an incredibly thoughtful mm-hmm. person who really believes in rehabilitation, who really believes in providing for his inmates the opportunity to succeed. And they've seen with budget cuts and the introduction of private prisons in Oklahoma that they are trying to accomplish this in their correctional programs, and they're not being able to because they don't have the tools. So right. I think the Department of Corrections in Oklahoma was happy to show the downside mm-hmm. of what's going on with these long sentences, and that they don't have the facilities and the manpower to embrace these inmates and right. help them to succeed. And I think the director and the Department of Corrections was hopeful that this film could help shed light on that and maybe help people understand that our prisons need our attention.
Right. And one of the other characters in the film that I thought was very thoughtful was the federal judge, who said that he's sent 2,600 people to prison for violating drug laws, and only three or four of them were kingpins. And he's a maverick when it comes to sentencing reform. And you had great access to him as well. He was talking. He let you in the courtroom to interview with the person sentenced. He let you. He was very open in his chambers about what he felt about this. Tell me more about him.
Yeah, Federal Judge Mark Bennett, who is an incredible force for good. And it took me about 6 months of calling back and forth with the judge and convincing him that he really should speak to me, because it was obviously something that he was upset about. He really, the 100-to-1 ratio of disparity between crack sentencing and powdered cocaine right. sentencing has led to a lot of racial disparity in our jails. And he really thinks it was a mistake, and he really wants to see it go to 1-to-1. So his sentencing has reflected that. But there's kind of a code of silence among federal judges where they don't really speak out. But I think he feels like we're at a tipping point, and it doesn't matter right. that judges are just supposed to carry out the law. At a certain point, you have to say these laws aren't right. And so after the film, he actually also wrote an op-ed piece for The Nation that came out against mandatory minimums and also called for other federal judges to speak out and say how they felt about drug law sentencing. But just, you know, this idea of that he's sentencing poor people and not kingpins, if we look at the last number, which is 2007, we had a little over 1.8 million arrests for drug violations. Over 82% of those were for possession. Only 17.5% was for manufacturing or distribution. So the majority of people who are filling our jails for drug violations are there for possession, for petty use. Mostly they're drug users. They are not the kingpins that all the politicians and the TVs say we're locking up.
Right. And your film profiles several of the drug users. You also have this great access with a drug dealer. You have the camera in the car while she's talking about doing drug deals, and you talk to several generations of men who are kind of caught in this cycle. Can you talk about how you portrayed this cycle?
Sure. I mean, I don't think we're talking about a black and white issue when we talk about drug abuse and drug policy in our country. It's really complicated. And our laws have tried to fix the problem that we have with drug abuse in this country. And in a way, they've made it a lot worse because they've criminalized it and led to more violence. And these communities, they don't have other opportunities. Mm-hmm. So they end up caught in this cycle of selling drugs and then using drugs and selling drugs. And, you know, when 1 in 3 young black men are going to prison in their lifetime, you end up with a lot of children without role models because their male influences are in jail. So the cycle continues because then they look up to the drug dealer in the community and they don't have other inspirations for what is success? Right. Because in their neighborhood, the drug dealer has the fancy car. He's got the girls. He's got the money. So there's this continuing cycle of, you know, a father goes away because he sold drugs. And then who does his son look up to but the drug dealer in the neighborhood? So it just continues. And it's really hard to break that if there isn't role models and opportunities.
And the I neglected to go back on the mandatory minimum and the disparity between crack mm-hmm. and powder cocaine. There has been fairly recently some changes in that policy, right? Can you explain that?
Yeah. So, when crack hit the scene, our legislators rushed to make these very strong mandatory minimums to treat it much harsher than other drugs, they associated it with violence or for whatever reason. You know, scientifically, crack and cocaine have the same effect. So it was a 100-to-1 ratio. And I think we can all associate crack use with poor inner city, mm-hmm. mostly minority use. And cocaine is more of a wealthy person's drug. So the sentencing was that if you had 5 grams of crack, you got the same as if you had 500 grams of cocaine. And that was the ratio for a really long mm-hmm. time. And it just last year went down to 18-to-1, which I still consider to not be justice. But a lot of people are going to get out because of this change. And a lot of people who would be going in for lengthier sentences will have shorter sentences. So it's a good thing, but it's a little bit comical when you think of the fact that, powdered cocaine is actually what you use to make crack cocaine. You mm-hmm. bake it in an oven with baking soda, or you do different things to make crack cocaine. So the idea that you literally need cocaine to make crack mm-hmm. makes the idea that the drug should be treated any differently a little bit far-fetched.
Right. And the one thing that I was also struck by, and you at the end of the, and it was at the end of the trailer, a quote from a Harvard professor,
Charles Ogletree.
Yeah, yeah. He said, quote, "This is a war on all Americans. People keep saying it's about them. No, it's about you." So how do you try to get that across, that it's about, that this affects everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's affected by the drug war. When we're talking about $1 trillion over the last 40 years, the amount of good that could have done for our society being funneled into schools and youth opportunities, there's a lot that we're all missing. And then we're all, I think, you know, you have a brother, you have a sister, you have a friend, you have a colleague, somebody who gets hooked on drugs, and the idea that our society doesn't treat that as a medical problem and rushes to lock them up, we're losing, because those people need our help. They need to be treated. Mm-hmm. There's a famous quote by Pastor Niemeyer that relates to the Holocaust, where he says, you know, when they came for the Russians, I didn't stand up because I wasn't Russian. And when they came for the Jews, I didn't stand up because I wasn't a Jew. And then when they came for me, there was nobody left to stand up. And we're eroding our civil liberties with our drug laws. You know, they can illegally search you. They're taking away your rights. And just because it's not you, your neighbor is very similar to you. Mm-hmm. And if you don't stand up for them, then there's going to be nobody left to stand up for you. So we really have to pay attention to what's going on with these policies, because politicians have used a lot of fear tactics to convince us that they're doing the right thing. But in the end, it's hurting our communities and our society.
Yeah. Speaking of politicians, let's go back to Nixon. Jarecki points out that when Nixon started the war on drugs in 1971, that it was a way to get his poll numbers up, because the rate of drug use was actually going down at the time. But he also dedicated 2/3 of his budget fighting the war on crime to rehabilitation, 2/3 for rehabilitation. And that hasn't continued, has it?
No. I mean, Nixon, when he started, was devoting a lot to treatment and rehabilitation, especially because, you know, we were dealing with vets coming back from the war who were using heroin. And that was very successful, the treatment arm of it. But that wasn't successful in the polls. Mm-hmm. And when Reagan came into office, we saw a militarization and a ratcheting up of this war that we hadn't seen before, and the treatment really took a backseat to interdiction.
I'd like to talk a bit about the advocacy and outreach aspect of the movie, but before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. And also our website will have a link to the movie's website, thehouseilivein.org, and people can find where the movie is showing in their area. It will be shown around the country in the coming months. And where else is it showing?
Yeah, we're showing around the country. And then also on January 15th, we'll be on iTunes. And then in April, we are very lucky to be showing on Independent Lens on PBS on April 8th, who have been a huge supporter of the film. So we're very thankful for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Independent Lens.
Okay. And you can also send questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbi.org or our Facebook page. And you can follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Now, at the end of the film, the screen goes black, and then there some text comes up about it says we need your help.
Yeah.
And there's a number to text too.
Mm-hmm.
So doing a documentary these days, it's not just about doing the documentary and calling it quits. Tell us more about that aspect.
Yeah, I think we're in a very exciting time. It's not like you just make a movie about something that nobody knows about and then they know about it. You actually can point them towards solutions. And my movie is already pretty long at 108 minutes. And there's, you know, so much to say about this issue. It's a huge issue, but we don't have space for solutions in the film. But we do have space online. So on our website, you can enter your zip code and be linked to organizations and actions in your area. The film has a text campaign that, you know, hopefully when we have enough people signed up and there's a good action that can happen, we will have a mobilization of people to help with legislative action or, you know, whatever that action at the time will be. But it's a very powerful time to make films with social media, with the ability to harness actions through that is incredible. And we've had a very large outreach for this film. We're really lucky to have a lot of foundation funding from Ford Foundation to the Bertha Foundation, Open Society Institute, to help us to do screenings in prisons,
right,
churches, schools. We're at professional conferences showing this film to law enforcement, to judges, to lawyers.
And politicians. How was it received at the
RNC and the DNC, and it went really well. I mean, you know, there's not a lot to argue with in this film. It's filmed on the ground. It is fact. The nice thing about the film, especially for those in the criminal justice field, which is so siloed, is that they kind of get a window to see inside a prison or inside a judge's chamber if they're a police officer. They see this thing that they don't get to see, and they get to say, like, wow, they're grappling with a lot of the same problems I am.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very well received, and it's very much a good tool for making people aware of this incredible crisis we're in, where we have all these people locked away, and the problem of drug abuse in our country is not getting any better. It's only getting worse.
Sundance called this film a masterpiece filled with hope and the potential to affect change. So it goes along that idea as well. But there some things have changed recently. Laws in Colorado and Washington to legalize marijuana. Do you think that that's going to play a role in this
debate? I do
debate?
Think it will play a role. It's very exciting. On Election Day, Washington had a ballot initiative, I-502, that legalized marijuana, and Colorado had Amendment 64. It'll take those states both time to figure out the regulations that will go along with those policies, about a year. And in the meantime, it's in direct against what the federal policy is. So we'll see in the next few months what the Obama administration chooses to do on this issue. If the feds are going to come in and say you're in violation of federal law, marijuana is not legal, or if they're going to say, oh, you know what, this is an experiment. Let's see what happens. What we've been doing hasn't been working. Let's give the state its chance to figure out mm-hmm. a better way to do things.
Let's move quickly to, with a few minutes left, internationally. Do you know of any countries that face a similar drug problem to the U.S. and were able to turn it around?
I don't know any country that's faced exactly the same problem as the U.S. We are, you know, the supersized version of every mm-hmm. problem. But Portugal is a model you can look at of somebody who's doing something different. And they've decriminalized drugs across the board, and they've seen no spikes in crime. They've seen rates of addiction actually drop among their youth. And they've set up a system where instead of going to a criminal justice system, somebody caught with drugs actually goes into a counseling session, a mm-hmm. treatment, you know, and they help them figure out like, oh, you're taking drugs. Maybe it's because you don't have a job. Let's help you find a job. Oh, you're selling drugs. Maybe you don't have a house to live in, so you're trying to make ends meet. Let's see if we can get you into public housing. So it's a more of a safety net approach versus a big stick. And they've had success with that. I mean, it's hard to compare Portugal to America because they're very different. Mm-hmm. So I think the exciting thing about Washington and Colorado trying to do this experiment with legalizing marijuana is that we can see what would happen right. on our own soil with our own values and our own population.
Let me ask you just one, if you can answer briefly, we have in our short time we have left. Why do you do this? Why do you spent 4 years on this? You must work incredible hours.
Yeah, I think we have an incredible human rights crisis in our own country. We have an incredible amount of people in jail. These are people's sons, daughters, husbands, fathers, mothers, and we have to care about them. It's statistically, the drug war has been really racially biased, and that's not okay. And we have to stop. And I really don't care how we got here. To not acknowledge that we are here is a travesty, and we have to figure out a way to move forward. There has to at least be a dialogue that what we're doing isn't working.
Well, thank you so much. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today was documentary producer Melinda Shopshin. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist.